If that's true or not, I know it was a great gift that Eileen gave me that day, I'll tell you, to feel that in any way I had given something back to Dorothy for all that she'd given me. One more question, I'm told. Are you pointing at him or are you pointing at your... Okay, how about you?
You said, don't be concerned about success, but there's something to be said for effectiveness. St. Francis on his deathbed, I think, said, till now we failed, we must start over. And Dorothy's vision was that every parish would have a Catholic worker house and every Catholic house would have a Christ room, and that certainly hasn't happened. If you could speak to that, that's awesome. If you could also speak, because I have a follow-up question. If you could also speak to...
Is this the White House here?
Talk about leaving the Catholic worker and living as a layperson out in the world with that experience and how that translates.
I'll try to keep it brief. We're getting hungry and restless. First question, Dorothy said, success doesn't matter, but is it important or not that the vision that she represented, or Peter Moran, that every house should have a Christ room, every parish should have a Christ room or something like that, certainly hasn't taken form. What way to think of that? I think she felt, are we indifferent about results, effectiveness? I don't think indifferent. But she had very much a consciousness that the results are ultimately not in our hands. All that we have responsibility for and our duty is in the present to do what we feel is right, to live by those principles, with the confidence that ultimately the fruit, the harvest, is for other hands and it's in God's hands, and that gives us a certain amount of freedom, rather than just the discouragement or bitterness or frustration that we can get, and often, especially in the peace movement, we can feel we protested over and over and over and over again, and the war still goes on and whatever. I think it matters a lot whether the war ends or not. It's not a matter of indifference whether the war ends. It's not a matter of indifference whether people are sleeping homeless. But we just don't control that outcome. And so I think her emphasis was all on the present and what we can do. The follow-up, I don't know what it has to do with the first question, but it's two questions for the price of one, was my leaving the Catholic worker, okay? I became a Catholic, and right around that time, I began to feel that the Catholic worker was not my vocation, and that it's sort of like Thoreau when he went into the wilderness, for a couple of weeks or something, the Walden Pond, and he writes about why did I leave, And he said, for very much the same reasons I went. And when I left, it was because I had other lives to live. And I felt that I'd learned something precious from the Catholic worker. I honor those who have stayed and for whom that was their vocation. But I felt I'd learned a lot of what I'd come seeking and a lot more, and now was to take that into the world. And, Dorothy's feeling is she, of course, love you all, but she did not feel that the Catholic worker was wherever, that the whole church should become the Catholic worker, everybody belonged in the Catholic worker house. She had, she often talked about it as a kind of school where people came for a while to find their vocation. And those who I think were part of it, or any of you have been part of it, even if you leave, you'll always carry something with you and never be the same. And her hope was that it would serve as a kind of a leaven, I think, in the church and society, and many thousands of people would pass through this movement, and not just learn about pacifism, and not just learn about the tradition of labor struggles and distributism and all those kind of ideas, but would learn to root ideas in practice, and the importance of personal relationships and personal contact, and the importance of small things. And not looking always for what's big and successful and what is impressive. She loved that line of William James about how I'm done with big things and grand projects, and all I really believe in are like little drops of water that can run underground, but that can crumble the greatest monuments of man's pride. And I think she had a great belief in the efficacy over time of just small seeds pebbles cost, you know, cast into a pond. For my own journey, yeah, I mean, I went on to study theology. I ended up being married. I had family and kids. I lived in a way very far from, you know, St. Joseph House in the Bowery, in the suburbs of Westchester, etc., subject to all of the compromises and complexities of that life. But in, you know, giving me my kind of direction in life as a writer, as an editor, Dorothy believed that everything we do, no matter what kind of job it is, it can offers an opportunity to practice the works of mercy, and it offers an opportunity to be a peacemaker. And so I became an editor, a publisher, but I hope a certain kind of publisher, and the editor of a lot of her writings, among other things. Somebody's got to do that. I even have these nice books to read, if people like me are not doing that job. And up to the present now, this, you know, to be asked by Marquette to edit her diaries, felt in some ways that I had never really left, that this was kind of brought me full circle on a journey that began when I knocked on the door when I was 19. I'll end it there. Thank you very much.
This is Vincent Irene with Blast Furnace Radio at the National Catholic Worker Gathering celebrating the 75th anniversary of the Catholic Worker Movement. And today we have with us
Lisa Apper from the St. Benedict Catholic Worker in Fresno, California.
Now, Fresno is not the East Coast. Do you find being a Catholic worker is easier when you're on the West Coast?
You know, there's a lot of Catholic workers on the West Coast now and more communities. We don't feel as isolated as we used to 30 years ago when there were very few and the East Coast was where it was happening.
So tell us your favorite Catholic worker story.
Favorite Catholic worker story. Well, my favorite Catholic worker story actually was one Dorothy told me in 1972. And Dorothy used to travel by Greyhound bus to visit her Catholic workers. She spent a lot of time doing that. And she took the Greyhound bus because that's how the poor traveled. And she told us a story. She was waiting for the bus in the terminal one day, and she fell asleep. And the security guard just went up to her, and he pushed her, and he said, "You know, this is for paying customers. You need to leave." And she said, where most people would be insulted, she felt he had given her an honor because he thought she was homeless. And I was 20 years old at the time, and little did I know that there was a message there. And as the years went by and I was involved in the Los Angeles Catholic Worker and then our own Catholic Worker, I think about that, and that's just that total identification with the poor. And she was telling us that, you know, it's not just about what you think or what you do, but where your heart is and where your physical presence is with the poor.
Yeah, one time Phil Berrigan says, "Hope is where your ass is."
Yes, love that one too.
Tell us about your house.
Well, our house was founded on July 27, 1997, and our ministry is to Fresno County Jail. We actually serve on the porch of the jail, and we serve meal three times a week. About 600, we feed about 600 people a week, and we also are a house of hospitality for homeless single women. Recently, we've been involved in a lawsuit on behalf of the homeless against the city of Fresno for taking their things and destroying them.
Now, that's not the good part. The good part is how much was won.
Yeah, actually, total $2.2 million.
And who's in charge of that money?
This Catholic worker you're looking at. Which is kind of daunting, but, you know, God gives us something to work with. And we just feel so great about the fact that, and it's not just about the money, but the message is clear, that criminalization of the homelessness will not be tolerated. And that for once, homeless people really gave their sound and voice resounding and the powers that be heard. And Judge Wanger of the 3rd District Court in Federal Court in Fresno just said, "This has got to end. These are citizens and they have a right to their own property."
So when the stuff was taken, it was in, was it a tent city?
Well, there were several encampments, but it also happened individually to people. So when we had... When we had it first started as a temporary injunction to prevent the city from doing these things, and then we were granted, before we got the permanent injunction, we had a hearing and 2 days of testimony and witnessing and photographs and video, and the deck was stacked, and the city had nothing more to do but to say, you know, we better settle. This is it.
So a lot of the stuff was irreplaceable. It was like ID and family photos,
yeah,
and this ashes. This was it. This is all the people.
And you know, I testified also as a professional pastoral counselor, and as to the, you know, psychological and spiritual effects that this had on people. I mean, not only materially, but here you had people. One of our homeless folk had a couple of dogs, and they were ripped from her and taken to the SPCA. I mean, there were just all kinds of things going on that not only traumatized people, but it just made them feel like they were less than human in the city's eyes.
Now, have you heard from other cities in terms of people who have gone through this but not won lawsuits?
You know, especially at this conference, at this gathering, there's been a number of Catholic workers who've come up to us and said they are facing the same struggles. And with, you know, redevelopment, especially in downtown areas where Catholic workers are, there is a campaign to push out the poor, and that's exactly what this was. We'll make it so uncomfortable for you, we will literally take your home and dispose of it, and you'll have nowhere to go but out of here.
Now, up until this time, I mean, I've been following this stuff for years, up until this time, nobody ever won a case.
Yes, it was, you know, our first goal was just to get a temporary injunction to stop them from doing it. And then the firm of Heller Ehrman, who was our pro bono attorney, said, you know, I think we have the makings of a class action suit here. And through their hard work and the ACLU and Central California Legal Services and our contact with the poor, the homeless people who were suffering under this, you know, we got it together and we had the evidence, and we were just so happy that the judge was not only sympathetic but very educated in what we were trying to present, and took that and said, you know what, this is breaking the law.
Well, usually when this happens, the homeless scattered to the four winds, and people are very, very upset, and they try to find some lawyers to pull things together. Is Fresno a small community? Is that why you were able to pull all the aspects of this together?
Well, the thing about the Fresno homeless community is it's pretty stable. We don't have a lot of people moving in and out of town, moving in various parts. It's a pretty stable community, and we pretty much know, because of our soup line downtown in front of the jail and contact with other areas and agencies that have served the homeless, that we are assured of a stable population, so that when we... You know, we had to actually, it's hard for people, especially people who've been traumatized, to be able to write down exactly what happened and how it happened. But we were able, with the attorneys, to set up tables at encampments and have people come to us. We made it very, very friendly, user-friendly, so that people could, you know, fill out these applications with some help and be able to have a voice in what was happening to them, and to realize, I mean, we had people too that were suffering from schizophrenia, that had really hard for them to put two things together, but when we worked with them, it was fairly easy to do that, and with that kind of help, we were able to pull 200 litigants together.
Oh my goodness, 200?
Yeah.
In situations like this, you're lucky if you're able to pull four together.
Yeah, well, we had 9 primary ones, and unfortunately, the key person in the title case, Pam Kincaid, died before this decision came. We were very, very upset. But, you know, those 8-9 courageous people, I mean, they went through all kinds of things. In just being in this lawsuit, there were actually homeless agencies, people who deal with the homeless and the poor, who blackballed them, who wouldn't let them eat at their place, who wouldn't let them shower, wouldn't let them. One of our ladies, who was one of the main litigants, was actually fired from her her volunteer job, in which she got food vouchers working at a day shelter, and they fired her. And then our attorneys, you know, discussing wrongful termination. They rehired her. They waited a little bit, and then they fired her again. And she was very dependent on those food vouchers, and, you know, really suffered greatly. So there was an ostracization by several service organizations who serve of people who were in the lawsuit. And even when we brought the applications, we had certain agencies that said, no, we won't do this.
So the whole thing is over, the money's been won, and now it's time to distribute the money.
Well, yes, right now we're in the process of each person has to reapply. And so we're in the process of getting those applications in, sorting them as to the amount of money each one will get. So there's like five categories. And the court has kind of given us a fluidity with it. You know, we can give as little as $100 and as much as maybe a year or two of rent. So for someone. So that's, you know, for people, that's a lifeline.
And that figure again is?
$1.4 million.
As Dan Berrigan once said, if this is poverty, give me chastity.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's nice to see, you know, in the film Philadelphia, one of the pristine moments that I love of that film is when they asked Tom Hanks' character why he went into law. And he said, I went into law because sometimes, not always, but sometimes, justice is served. And that was it for us.
So being from Pittsburgh, I don't know anything about Morgantown, West Virginia, but in Fresno, are you on the coast?
No, we're in Central. Actually, if you look at California like a banana, yep, we're exactly in the center. We're 200 miles south of San Francisco, 200 miles north of LA.
How far are you from the beach?
About 3 hours.
Oh, my goodness. So if people want to visit the Fresno Catholic Worker, will you take them to the beach?
We will take them to Yosemite, which to me is better than the beach. Actually, we're near three national parks, Yosemite, Kings Canyon, and Sequoia, all within an hour's drive to the entrances. So you haven't been to heaven, as John Muir would say. He called Yosemite the Sanctum Sanctorum, and you haven't been to heaven until you've been there.
Now, the rumor is through the media, though, since I haven't had it confirmed, glad to talk to you about this, is that you're going to buy Yosemite.
Ah! You know, we have several trips a year where we take our homeless folk up there, and you'd be surprised. Fresno's an hour away, but some of them have never been there. Fresno residents, a majority of them. And so it's just a healing for the soul. And we'll take a picnic up, and we'll bring a half a dozen folks, either guests from our house or our people that from the street. And it's just, it's a healing place. So we encourage Catholic workers and anybody who's out there who would like to come to our community, stay, help us serve, and come to Yosemite with us.
And do you have a phone number?
Yes. My phone number is area code 559-229-6410.
That number again?
559-229-6410.
That's Lisa from the St. Benedict Catholic Worker out in Fresno. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, that was very painless.
Without an audience.
And here we are at the Catholic Worker Gathering. The format is lecturing, just what I needed. But we're also interviewing different Catholic workers and their stories. And this afternoon we have with us
Frank Cordero, Des Moines Catholic Worker.
Frank, tell us a Catholic worker story.
Well, a Catholic worker story? Well, 1977, steps of the Pentagon with Jonah House folks. I'm at a pillar with four other folks prepared to do a blood spilling. Very nervous. My first attempt at civil disobedience. And I'm beginning to have second thoughts. And out of the door of the VIP door of the Pentagon comes Mr. Amadeo, my eighth grade teacher at St. Anthony's, who is now an officer for the Air Force. And as he's walking down the steps, I yell out to Mr. Amadeo, Coach Amadeo. He turns around and looks at me, the protester with the bib overalls and the long hair and beard, and he says, Cordero, and comes up and starts to talk to me. Everyone around us just could not believe. There we were, the Pentagon, right at the height of an August 9th demonstration with the Berrigans in the crowd, and this one demonstrator from Iowa, who's about to do a blood spilling, meets his eighth grade teacher, who's an Air Force captain. And they're talking. And we talk about old times. And then he looks me in the eye and he says, Frank, do you know what you're doing? And I looked him back in the eye and says, yeah, coach, I do. In fact, he asked me that three times. Now, Mr. Amadeo could have said a lot of things. Like, oh, yeah. Good point, Carl. He could have said a lot of things like, your father is turning in his grave. You're a great embarrassment. Why are you doing this? But all he wanted to know was, do I know what I'm doing? And all of my insecurities disappeared. Now, it's one thing to have your eighth grade teacher come out of the Pentagon and ask you, do you know what you're doing? And you can say to him with all full confidence, yes, indeed, I do. It's another thing to do the blood spilling right in front of him. So I began to get a little nervous, like, coach, move on. You got to go. Well, the VIP brought the van for him, or the car that he was in. He said, Officer Amadeo, you need to go. I says, see you, coach. He shook my hands, got in the car, left. And as soon as he left, the signal was given to do the blood spilling. I dropped my banner. I took the bottle of blood out of my pocket, put it onto the pillars, and no sooner did the blood go to the pillars than my hands were cuffed. I was taken under the canopy, and we were yelling, the Pentagon. Oh, the Pentagon. The Pentagon, a temple of death. And that was my first arrest.
And the year was?
1977.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. And so how old is the Catholic Worker House that you're in?
We're 32 years young and still going.
And we had a lot of rain out there recently. Did you get your basements rebuilt?
No, we're still in the assessing the need to deal with our foundational issues. Lots of mud and otter water came through. Luckily, we weren't in a floodplain. But it's a great metaphor because we're dealing with the revamping of our community also. These are periodic things, and we now need to pay attention to foundational issues, both in our basements and in our lives as community.
So, Frank, were you part of putting this together?
No, except that I was part of the inspiration. We put a national gathering in Iowa 2 years ago, and we had $5,000 left over. So at the end of that, we let it be known that we'll give any crazy community that wants to do the next national a $5,000 grant free to start it. And we had something to do with talking Scott and Claire and the folks here in Worcester to do it. And once they signed on, we signed our check over to them, and here we are.
Well, that's wonderful. That's what we need. People inspiring others to do things. To do their work. Carl, what are you doing out of jail?
Yes,
ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Cabot. A temporary lapse. He's on the streets.
I'll be damned if I know what I'm doing out of jail. Excuse my name. I'm sorry. I really don't know. I mean, I got out in July 20th last year. And I figured I owed myself a little year. I didn't know they were celebrating my birthday. This is my 75th year of life, and I didn't know that my birthday celebration would be this big. I'm just pulling your leg, by the way, anyway.
Are you 75?
Yeah, yeah.
That means you were born the year of the Catholic Worker.
1933, absolutely. Anyway, no, I'm, as I say, right now, I got out last year in... Actually, July 20th, and I went around and saw many people. Like Frank, where Frank Cordero lives, is kind of off the beaten path. But I made Baltimore, Washington. I made Curry Beach, North Carolina. I made Madison, Wisconsin, and Salt Lake City, Utah, Denver, Colorado, and Colorado Springs. So I've kind of got. It's probably the last time of my life that I'll do all this. But I'm just now enjoying life and. Came out here, it was great, it's been great.
So where are you staying?
St. Louis. St. Louis Mo, huh?
What do they call that house you live in there, Carl?
I'm so old, I forget. I think Frank will have to. I can't remember. Maybe Frank will have to.
Carl Cabot is staying at the Carl Cabot Catholic Worker House in St. Louis. Carl is the nuclear resistor who's done more time than any other nuclear resistor, nonviolent nuclear resistor. And he was part of the original Plowshares 8, and he specializes in missile silos. And out in the Midwest, they take their missile silos quite seriously, and so does Carl. And it's been a relationship of over 25 years.
Now, was it true years ago that you were talking about your first missile action and you were talking about boom, boom?
Well, where did you get that, by the way?
Liz told me that as she was having a cornea.
Okay. Well, that was at the time we were at Plowshare 8 had happened in 1980. This was like about 1983 or so, 84. And just trying to brainstorm about and whatever, you know. And, with free associating, all kinds of things pop through your mind, huh? I know Elmer Moss, who's now dead, almost stuck his finger up my nose. Carl, don't do that, Carl, don't do that, Carl. He almost had his finger up my nose. I mean, I just
said. Do what?
Well, whatever you call that boom, boom thing.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, will be added to the silence that brings us even that much closer to God.
But we did. But we did.
Well, life goes on here at the Catholic Worker National Gathering. I don't know who came up with the idea that in our graying years that we needed to hear lectures for a few days, but that's what's going on, and that gives me some time away from that. And this afternoon we have with us
Janet Ward.
Janet Ward is an old friend. She also was with Dorothy in her waning days, in her waning months before she died. And Janet, what was it like to be with Dorothy for the few months before she left us?
Well, I was there actually for the final 3 years that she lived. And it was just an honor. You know, I was able to bring her breakfast and sit on her bed and talk to her as though she was my own grandmother. And yet there came from her something that was just so amazing. And she was very, very kind. Her memory was going, though, when I moved there, and she'd often forget who I was, and she would connect Worcester and connect that to Michael True, who's an old peace activist from here, and she'd always tell me stories about Michael. But Dorothy was wonderful, and she rooted the people that went off to jail, and I remember once bringing her breakfast and being told she was depressed and to go in and try to cheer her up. And so I went in and remarked about the loveliness of the light on the building or the tree out in the yard. And she said, "How can you be so shallow? Don't you know young Ellsberg's at Rocky Flats?" And, you know, I was like, "Okay, here's your oatmeal." And yes, so, you know, I'm dying to tell Robert that story. And he was out there actually with Brian Terrell at the time.
Did she actually write up until the end in her diaries?
Well, you know, I don't have a copy of them, but I'm just looking at the one that's on display here. And I talked to Robert Ellsberg, the author, and he assured me I was in the book. So I went over to the display table to look, and it is, and it's all great, because it's all entries when I was in jail. And Dorothy is all worrying about us all in jail, because she wanted so much to go, and it was her own frail body that was keeping her from going. But, God, you read those last few pages of entries, and it's all about who's in jail and how long they've been in jail and what's happening to the houses and how much she wished to be with us.
Isn't that funny how that with this newest book out about her diaries, I didn't even know these existed.
Yes.
You did. Okay, I didn't know they existed. Isn't it funny that the only way that us as Catholic workers are going to get this book is by stealing it from that table over there?
Well, yeah, I tried to do that, and they told me that it was better to sign up and buy it at a discount. So that's what I'm going to do. But, I'm grateful. I'm interested to read the rest of them because I really liked Robert's other works. And I just finished reading the book about Catholic Worker, The Next Generation. which I really, really adore. I love it. Do you know the book I'm speaking of?
Yeah, I don't like it. But anyways, you remember those books that they were going to throw away?
Yes.
The trilogy?
Yes.
And I said, I'll get a box of those next time I'm in town, you know. Like, yeah. I took one home, and now they're nowhere to be found.
No.
And the glue was bad.
Yeah.
And so there's pages of these three books all over my house.
I exactly know what you mean. My On Pilgrimage the 60s
yeah.
is just in pieces. And
have they ever reprinted those?
They are in print somewhere around the room. I've seen like copies, new copies of From Union Square to Rome, new copies of On Pilgrimage. So I know there are a lot of things.
You know the story behind that?
No.
They were the publishing company was asked to destroy the books because they had gone bankrupt. So part of bankruptcy was that they couldn't make any more money from books, and so they said, "We will comply with your wishes to the federal courts." With bankruptcy, and so the publishing company showed up at the Catholic Worker with boxes of books.
Right, where I first lived in Mary House, one whole wall of the room was made with the boxes from the books. And yeah, they were ubiquitous around the Catholic Worker. For, you know, there'd just be stacks of them, push them this way, shove them that way. And yeah.
Now there's not one box left.
No, there's not, but.
Okay, give me one more, hopefully your fave, Dorothy Day story. When you were with her?
Well, I remember I got pregnant when I was at the Catholic Worker, and I remember going...
Most of us did.
Oh. Well, I was the only one at Mary House at the time, and I went in to tell Dorothy that I was going to have a baby. And Therese had just come out, her book on St. Teresa. And she reached for it, and she grabbed it, and she said, I think you should read this. And before she handed it to me... She wrote, to Janet Ward, with love, admiration, parentheses, envy, question mark, parentheses. And she just talked about how much she would love to have another child. And when the baby was born, she called me to see that I would come over with the baby. And just months before she died, she took the baby into her arms and kissed Mara on the foot and told me that was an old Russian blessing and gave me one of her wonderful smiles and little giggles and... I miss Dorothy. I miss the Catholic Worker. I miss the house.
And now, drum roll please, Dorothy's final words.
Dorothy's final words. Well, they weren't her final words.
One of her final words.
Well, no, it was just while I was living at the house one day, I'm a little bit overweight, and I was standing with my back to Dorothy, getting her medications ready. And she said to me, you know, from that angle, I think, sometimes women in pants look like the rear end of a horse. And I thought, she's calling me a horse's ass. And then I turned around. Hi, Mary Lathrop. And so I turned around and I said, Dorothy, I don't understand. And she said, well, I think it's a lot less revealing if women wear skirts.
By the infamous, famous Frank Cadero. You've probably seen his name in print. He is a man who has taken seriously the gospel mandate to spread the good news, and he's figured out how to do that in cyberspace because he's the keeper of the National Catholic Worker emailing list. So he will speak second, and then I forgot to introduce myself, Claire Schaefer Duffy from the St. Francis and Therese Catholic Worker will bring up the rear.
All right.
And then the mic will be open to all. We'll just take it from there. So we'll start with Bishop.
Thank you very much. As I mentioned last night, and I am not a member of a Catholic Worker house, but I am a very committed follower of Catholic Workers wherever you are. I'm very honored to be able to be with you tonight and to share in this round table. And certainly, peacemaking is, I think you have to see it's the very essence of the Catholic Worker movement, because it certainly was probably the most prominent thing in the life, one of the most prominent things in the life of Dorothy Day, who began this movement. The other day, or earlier this week, I saw the film by James Carroll called Constantine's Sword, based on his book of the same title. It's an extraordinary film, and I would suggest if you want to be disturbed, you probably should see the film or read the book. But in it, one part of it, it's a brief section, but it's very powerful. He shows how the Christian community at the time of Constantine began to veer away from the teachings of Jesus. And then for 1700 plus years, we have been unfaithful to the teachings of Jesus, because when Constantine became a Christian, it's really an impossible contradiction, but the Christian church became an empire. And that has gone on. It has to change. And Dorothy Day, as you probably, well, I'm sure you know, lived her life committed to nonviolence. But she was also very concerned about what the church taught and about what our government does in regard to war and peace. And you may not be aware that as the church in the early 1960s began to reverse all that had started with Constantine in the 4th century, began to be reversed with Pope John the 23rd and Pagan Terris, where in one sentence he eliminates from Catholic teaching a just war theology, makes it no longer Catholic teaching. And then the Vatican Council, and it's in the Vatican Council that Dorothy, together with Eileen Egan, Gordon John, Archbishop Thomas Roberts from England, were able to get into the Doctrine on the Church of the Modern World a couple of sections that show the new direction that the Church is going and must continue to go. Early on in the document, paragraph 8, there's a very important section about conscience and the necessity of everyone to make his or her own judgment in conscience and be ready to stand before God in regard to questions of war and peace and other moral questions. But further on, in paragraph 80, because of the work of Dorothy, we have a statement like this: the development of armaments by modern science has immeasurably magnified the horrors and wickedness of war. And here all the bishops of the world together are saying, all these factors force us to undertake a completely fresh reappraisal of war. People of this generation must realize they will have to render an account of their warlike behavior. The destiny of generations to come depends largely on the decisions they make. And so with these considerations, the Council, endorsing the condemnations of total warfare, declares every act of war directed to the indiscriminate destruction of whole cities or vast areas with their inhabitants is a crime against God and humankind, which merits firm and unequivocal condemnation. In that one sentence, bishops of Vatican II, and this is out of the instigation and the inspiration of Dorothy Day, the bishops declared war is no longer tenable, because war involves the destruction, indiscriminate destruction of whole cities and vast areas with their inhabitants. And a final part of this statement: God urgently demands of us that we free ourselves from the age-old slavery of war. If we refuse to make this effort, there is no knowing where we will be led on the fatal path we have taken. And so the bishops, and I again remind us that with the help of Dorothy Day, a member of the church who was committed to try to bring about profound change in the church, makes this kind of a statement, which in effect says war is no longer possible. It never really was possible for a follower of Jesus, but now we're reversing that 1700 years of the church's failure to teach authentically what Jesus came to teach. And this is just a brief opening statement, so I can't elaborate very much, but I want to make sure that we understand what we mean by indiscriminate destruction and the indiscriminate taking of human life, and how war has evolved in human history to mean nothing but that. There was an article some time ago in America Magazine entitled Terror Bombing, and it talks about World War II, Operation Gomorrah, ordered by Winston Churchill, meant the explosive and incendiary bombs were dropped in the city of Hamburg, July 24th, 1943. 5 days later, more than 50,000 civilians were dead. 2.5 years later, the city of Dresden, crowded with refugees of little strategic importance, was devastated by Allied bombers just 3 months before the war's end, making it a symbol in the world of the ruthlessness of modern warfare. Almost 500,000 civilians murdered in that bombing. In March of that year, the firebombing of Tokyo, 80,000 innocent civilians killed. After the raid, U.S. Army General Curtis LeMay declared, "There are no innocent civilians." And that's our teaching on war in the United States by our government, by our military. There are no innocent civilians. So war has become, as it's waged by the United States and other major powers, what we might call state terrorism. It has to be called that, nothing else. And so that leads us to the only conclusion that is possible. That, well, before I come to my conclusion, I just want to mention there's one other development here in the United States that we must become aware of. And that is what has happened in Omaha, Nebraska, where the Strategic Air Command has now become the Strategic Command and oversees the possibility of waging war anywhere in the world. Here is part of what this Strategic Command, not Air Command, but Total Command. It's now charged with actively waging the White House's war on terror. STRATCOM is authorized to attack any place on the planet in 1 hour, using either conventional or nuclear weapons on the mere perception of threat to the national interests of the United States. We cannot allow that to be our public policy. We simply cannot. It's totally against the gospel of Jesus. And so what I plead with us here tonight is that we, each of us, as Catholic workers, renew our commitment to the personal nonviolence that Dorothy exemplified it throughout her life, that we try to become people committed in our total being to nonviolent act of love of Jesus. But then we have to go beyond that. We have to work for public policy change. We have to work for the abolition of war. And it's possible. We had a president at one point who was leading us in this direction. And this may surprise us, but I invite you to read the book that Jim Douglas has on the table in the back, called The Unspeakable Truth, Why John Kennedy Was Killed and Why It's Important to Know It. And when you read that book, you'll become convinced that we have to say no to war, abolish war, and that that approach was beginning to be taken by John Kennedy. And here's what he said. September 25th, 1961, the first time he spoke at the United Nations as President of the United States. "Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us." That's the president of our country speaking. And he meant it, and he worked for that. "It's therefore our intention," he goes on to say in this speech, "to challenge At that point, he said the Soviet Union, but we should say all other nations, not to an arms race, but to a peace race, to advance together, step by step, stage by stage, until general and complete disarmament has been achieved. And President Kennedy took off on that path. In 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis, he refused to follow the military leaders who wanted to go to war against the Soviet Union. He refused to continue to support Vietnam. He refused to continue to support the embargo against Cuba. He was undertaking secret negotiations to wage peace step by step. It all ended, of course, on November 22, 1963. Because John Kennedy had violated the teachings of our military establishment. He had worked to change what our nation was doing. He was murdered. Read the book, you'll be convinced, I think, that John Kennedy would have led us on this waging of peace day by day. He was not able to do it, but we are.